The South Mountain Freeway appears to be driving ahead. ADOT is sending letters to homeowners in the way. But controversy still surrounds the project.
It would also require that they were going to have to blast through three ridges of South Mountain to be able to make this freeway. And I said, why?
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, could a big budget deficit lead to prison reform in Arizona? The We Are the Valley series continues on the dance floor.
And a basketball league for amputees is ready to tip off.
The biggest challenge for me was changing my perspective as to what I can do. I don't think I'll be dunking anytime soon.
Plus, is purple the new beige in the valley? And peeling back layers for a piece of Phoenix history.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Looking for a sunny, warm weekend around the valley, though not as warm as it is today. Should be a high in the lower 90s tomorrow and then hitting 90 on Sunday. Currently, we're mostly clear with 94 degrees. Quick check of traffic. Watch out for an accident 101 westbound. It's blocking the shoulder at 19th Avenue.
The Governor's Council on Infectious Disease Preparedness and Response had its first meeting this morning. Governor Brewer set up the panel earlier this week to make sure the state was ready to deal with Ebola and other infectious diseases. State Health Director Will Humble chairs the council and says members agreed to set up two work groups.
One is getting information to primary care physicians, nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, et cetera, about how to actually do the proper risk assessment on a patient who comes in with a fever. That's one work group. The other work group is to dive into the hospital system and identify a hospital or hospitals that will end up becoming the designated Ebola treatment hospital in Arizona.
Humble, though, says even with those facilities, every ER in the state will have to be able to do the right kind of risk assessment on patients, isolate them if necessary, and then get a sample to confirm they have Ebola. He says the state also needs an EMS protocol to get patients to the designated Ebola treatment hospital.
The Maryvale Golf Course will soon be under new management. As KJZZ's Kerry Young reports, Grand Canyon University has agreed to run the city course for the next 30 years.
The city and the university finalized the deal on Thursday. In addition to taking over course management, Grand Canyon University will also redesign and renovate the facility. Brian Mueller is the university's president.
Once we've recouped our investment, we'll have a revenue split with the city. We don't intend to make lots of money on it, but we expect it to be break-even or a little bit better, and then for it to become a huge resource for both Grand Canyon and the community.
According to Mueller, about 35,000 rounds of golf are played at the facility each year. He hopes the renovations will increase that number to 70,000. City officials estimate the golf course is currently operating at a $230,000 loss. Kerry Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Navajo Council late last night passed legislation that changes the language fluency requirement and allows a presidential candidate to stay on the ballot. From Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laurel Morales reports.
The decision comes after the Navajo Supreme Court postponed the tribe's presidential election and ordered Chris Descheny off the ballot. A lower court disqualified Descheny because he refused to prove his language skills, saying the process was biased. The council vote is just the latest in an ongoing battle between the tribe's judicial and legislative branches to control the election process. Navajo council members say they're concerned about disenfranchising tribal members who already voted early. The legislation still must be approved by President Ben Shelley. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
Getting from here to there in the valley in your car has gotten tougher over the past 30 years. That's how long a proposed South Mountain Freeway has been more than a gleam in the eye of freeway planners and traffic engineers. Last month, the Arizona Department of Transportation, along with the Federal Highway Administration, released the final environmental impact statement that moves the freeway creation process closer to the fast lane. And this week, ADOT started sending letters to homeowners and businesses in the path of the proposed stretch along Pecos Road in Ahwatukee. Rob Samore is a senior deputy state engineer for ADOT.
We have contacted about 175 to 200 property owners that will be impacted by this project in terms of needing to purchase property from them. We have reached out with a letter to notify them that they will be contacted by an appraiser.
What's the process the appraisers will go through?
They would look at comps or comparable properties in that area to determine market value. Homeowners, businesses have the opportunity to either go out and seek their own appraisal or challenge some of the findings in that appraisal in effort to make sure that we are addressing the fair market value. There are also those relocation costs that we're able to reimburse. Mm. There are provisions for what those can and cannot be. And so we try our best to work with the property owner as fairly and equitably as we can.
You've looked at many different concepts. If you could take me back in time just a little bit, were there any aspects or were there any potential alternatives that wouldn't have involved having to move either businesses or people out of their locations?
On the Pecos connection, we looked at alternatives on the community. As you know, they took up a vote and have a standing resolution that not only did they not support the project, the vote was no build. Pecos Road is the selected alternative on the east-west leg in the Southeast Valley. And so the freeway, as best as we can, will minimize impacts to those homes. However, when you're converting a four-lane local street or an arterial to an eight-lane urban freeway, there are going to be some impacts along those southernmost homes that were constructed on Pecos Road.
That was Rob Samore, Senior Deputy State Engineer for ADOT. One of the homeowners who received a letter from ADOT informing her that she'll need to start thinking about moving is Jessica Gage of Ahwatukee. She says she hadn't planned on opening her mailbox and finding that kind of correspondence.
I was surprised, since we've been in limbo with our property and the status of this possible freeway for years.
Gage and her family moved out of the house on Pecos Road and use it as a rental property. Her next step is to gather as much information about the real value of the house.
We may hire our own assessment or appraisal firm as well. ADOT's providing one, but they're also paid by ADOT. So we're looking into that as well as making sure they have some kind of relocation package or program for our tenant as well.
Other residents of Ahwatukee have been vocal in their opposition to the freeway stretch along Pecos Road. Pat Lawless is the president of Protecting Arizona's Resources in Children, or PARC.
It would also require that it go through South Mountain. And that became the most objectionable thing to me when I first heard about that, that they were going to have to blast through three ridges of South Mountain to be able to make this freeway. And I said, why? Well, their reason or excuse, depending on how you look at it, is that they don't have any alternative. Well, in our view, there are plenty of alternatives.
You're also concerned about the freeway's possible use as a truck bypass?
ADOT continues to say, oh, no, 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 that's not the purpose. Now, we can't stop trucks from using it, but that's not the real purpose. Well, that's baloney. That is the real purpose. The whole concept of having to put this freeway right there is so that it can go into the commercial area over around 51st Avenue and provide a shortcut for those trucks to and from. Well, this has been dealt with in the Phoenix area for a long time, that trucks provide a lot of pollution.
ADOT has sent letters to homeowners, and we've talked to one, about getting their properties appraised for purchase to make room for the freeway. Has that bothered you?
I saw something from a gentleman who said he was just ready to have his roof redone, and now is it worth paying $10,000 to have his roof redone? Well, ADOT has been threatening this for all the time that they have planned this, which is 30 years. But I guess it has become a very possible reality to these people all of a sudden. It is not a good situation for anyone in Ahwatukee who lives anywhere close to Pecos Road because, and I live close to Pecos Road. I do not live in a zone that my house would be taken. But if you live close to Pecos Road, you have lived with this over your head for all the time you've lived there. I mean, you could justify that, yes, ADOT's doing some prior planning, but I think they're also really to put fear into the population.
Pat Lawless of PARC. Her group has until November 24th to respond to the final environmental impact statement. She says suing ADOT is a likely upcoming step.
Drive just about anywhere in Phoenix and you'll see signs for and against Proposition 487 staring back at you. The ballot measure has been attacked by firefighters and police officers and applauded by conservative groups, and it's left many voters confused. So KJZZ's Stina Sieg tries to shed some light on what's officially called the City of Phoenix Pension Reform Initiative.
I'll go to the next street.
Okay, you got your ramp and everything?
No.
Okay.
Oh, I thought I was getting.
As the sun sets, a group of firefighters navigates through a North Phoenix neighborhood, going door to door.
I'd like to tell you that we're sweepstakes winners announcing you're winning a gazillion dollars, but we're actually Phoenix firefighters.
Oh, cool.
And we are walking in opposition to Proposition 487.
All right.
That's Captain Greg Hawks, who believes this ballot measure would not just change city pensions, but might actually strip him and his colleagues of benefits. Firefighter and police groups say the initiative is written in such a convoluted way, it could prohibit the city from contributing money to their pensions. Firefighter P.J. Dean says that could take away their death benefits, too. He says those are funded by their pensions.
If you remove those benefits from the equation and take that away from us, you know, I can't with a clean conscience put myself at risk to save other people when I know my family isn't going to be supported if something were to happen. I just can't leave them stranded like that.
Even if there's a chance, he says, that's too much. But Phoenix City Councilman Sal DeCiccio is calling foul. He thinks firefighters and their benefits are being trotted out by opponents of Prop 487 to manipulate the public.
The death and disability is just a complete lie. It's not even close to being true.
DeCiccio, who supports Prop 487, says it does not affect city firefighters or police at all. That's because they're part of a statewide pension plan. And this measure is supposed to only include employees with the city's plan.
Everybody gets to keep what they got at the City of Phoenix. Everybody gets to keep everything that they've earned. Just going forward, new employees would have to be under a 401k. It's not that complicated.
With these 401k-style plans, the retirement amount future employees would receive would depend on how their investments do. Compare that to current pensions, where retirees get a fixed percentage of their salaries for life. DeCiccio says Prop 487 would also end the practice of spiking, as in employees inflating their salaries with things like unused vacation and sick leave to bump up their pension. Negotiations earlier this year dealt with some of those spiking issues, but not all. When it comes to voters, DeCiccio says Prop 487 opponents are just trying to
confuse them, make them think that this is a bad idea, without talking about the merits of pension reform that need to happen. If you don't have pension reform, you're going to see higher costs.
Pretty much everyone on both sides of this fight agrees on that last point, but little else.
How do you determine who's right or who's correct or who's misleading?
Exactly. Tom Riley is the director of ASU's Morrison Institute for Public Policy. The institute is not taking a position on Proposition 487, but did host a citizens' review of it. Just everyday people wading through the complex language. And at the end of all that, results were mixed. They found that the city says the most likely outcome of the proposition is actually a cost, $345 million over the next 20 years. Legal experts who support the initiative point to another estimate from the city, a savings of more than $500 million. But that's if every aspect of it stands in court, which city officials believe is unlikely. Riley puts it this way.
Ultimately, you know, if it's challenged, you'll be up to the courts, not to legal experts.
The review also found it's unclear what effect, if any, the measure would have on firemen and police. They are mentioned in the ballot's description and the preamble of the proposition, but not at all in the body of its text. For Riley, the bottom line is this.
How we compensate public employees probably needs a rethinking, because it's too easy for elected officials to increase benefits because of payouts years later, long after they leave office.
And Riley says that conversation is happening all across the country as hefty pension bills are coming due. Here in Phoenix, he won't guess what will happen on Election Day, but both sides are gearing up for a court fight. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
As the state of Arizona faces another huge budget deficit, some advocates say the state could save by spending less on the Department of Corrections.
Donna Leone Hamm is the founder of Middle Ground Prison Reform, a nonprofit agency that works to protect the rights of the incarcerated. Some states have altered their criminal codes so that lower-level offenders are spending less time in prison. Donna, based on what you've heard from other states, does it seem like a good idea for Arizona?
Well, it certainly is a viable idea, and other states, including some pretty conservative states like Texas, have already done some modification to their sentencing and criminal code, which have allowed some earlier releases than previously allowed to happen, and some shorter sentences for nonviolent offenders. And they've been doing it now for several years without compromise to public safety. There hasn't been a rash of new crimes committed by these folks who've been released early or not sentenced to as much time.
Donna, at the risk of sounding too philosophical, does it strike you as odd, troubling, whatever the word may be, that something like this that may in fact make sense only gets advocates on board when we have major budget problems and we're looking for something?
Quite frankly, we're happy if we have to resort to seeing them take these measures into consideration due to cost factors, because frankly, the cost factors are a very important part of this. They will save money, and they will be able to put the money into other necessary services that should be presented to our citizens in this state that are being cut constantly at great social expense to our state. And so, yeah, if it takes flying in the face of a budget crunch, then we'll take that.
When we look at the budget outlay for the state, more than $1 billion, Department of Corrections, which is not far behind Access, pretty far behind Education, but still in the top three of Arizona's outlays here when it comes to the state budget. There's also been controversy over the private prison companies in Arizona. Are there concerns that if we move away from this particular state budget spending and we give more power to private prisons, is that a danger of even advocating for some changes when it comes to criminal code, if there are changes made but they're not quite as dramatic as you'd like to see?
Well, it's certainly troubling that part of the contract that the state has negotiated with all of the private prisons that we currently have under contract for Arizona prisons, there is a provision in those contracts that gives them a minimum guaranteed occupancy, and I believe it's 90%. And we have to pay for that many prisoners, whether those beds are full or not.
Any idea how much this would save the state and save the state budget?
The Department of Corrections, they will admit that each prisoner that they house costs them approximately $25,000 per year. So if you just take a multiple and say that every nonviolent offender who's in prison, which constitutes at least 40% of the prison population, if you took that and multiplied by 25,000 and even took half of those people and said that they could be appropriate to be released at 65% of their sentence instead of 85%, you'd begin to have some big savings there.
That's Donna Leone Hamm of Middle Ground Prison Reform.
Still to come, we visit a piece of Phoenix history, not that you'd know it.
There's a beautiful Victorian two-story detailed building entombed in this ugly facade.
The future of a part of Phoenix's past. That's ahead. It's the show. Sunny skies in the valley forecast for this weekend. Look for a high of 95, tomorrow 90 on Sunday, dropping down to about 86 on Monday. 94 degrees right now at KJZZ at 223. Quick check of valley traffic, accidents 101 westbound at 19th Avenue and on the 202 northbound Red Mountain Freeway at Broadway.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, where every day you'll find a variety of meal solutions with chef-prepared entrees, gourmet sandwiches, fresh-made soups and salads. 10 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
Halloween is 1 week away with its scary traditions, tricks, and treats. This is also the season for Dia de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead, which will be celebrated this weekend at the Mesa Arts Center. Festival spokesperson Ginny Montaño says despite some visual similarities, the holidays don't have much in common.
There's nothing spooky about Dia de los Muertos. The main characteristic of Dia de los Muertos, which happens November 1st and November 2nd, is that life is celebrated by receiving, really, the souls of the people that have passed away. During those 2 days, it's believed that the souls of the departed get to come and visit us. And as their souls leave from wherever they are, and they don't want to be lost. We don't want them to be lost. We want them to find their ways to us. The main attraction would be an altar, because the altar is a way that you set the stage for that particular soul. So let's say if grandma, she loved cocoa. Well, I'm going to put some cocoa in that altar. I'm going to put her pictures. I'm going to put the things that she liked doing, that she liked eating, that she liked drinking. Now, I'm also going to include things as candles, and that is also a way to show them the light, show them where to go.
It does sound a lot more significant than Halloween. So, but as far as not being spooky, for some people, the idea of returning souls can be kind of spooky, even if it's someone you miss.
It is a Mexican tradition that we kind of mock death. We're not afraid of death in that sense. You can see that all over, you know, like the sugar skulls. So sugar skulls are traditionally given to a person with their own name on the forehead. You know, like saying, you're going to die too, buddy. So here's your skull. And it is something that's very typical for Mexico to mock death and to celebrate it and to honor it and absolutely not be afraid of it. So for us, it's absolutely a joyous festivity. It's a very fun tradition. You know, you will see cemeteries lighten up with all sorts of music and people and flowers. They'll bring mariachis to the cemeteries. The whole family will go to the cemetery, and you can call it a picnic. You know, they will sit there and spend probably the whole day, sometimes even the whole night. So there is nothing scary about Dia de los Muertos for us.
I'm looking at you right now. You've got almost look like anchors on your cheeks drawn in. You've got the traditional sort of what looks like stitches sort of pulling your mouth apart.
Actually, everything is left to the person. And here's why. If you're going to decorate a sugar skull, the sky is the limit. You could put everything and anything on a sugar skull that you think would look good, nice, funky.
What's the mood of Dia de los Muertos?
Absolutely okay. Party. Party, party, party. Muy loco.
Ginny Montaño talking about this weekend's Dia de los Muertos at Mesa Arts Center.
KJZZ is supported by Mesa Arts Center. Produced by Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, One Drop of Love is a multimedia one-woman show starring Fanchon Cox D. Giovanni, exploring race in America November 1st. Tickets at mesaartscenter.com.
We head now to another of the Valley's threatened places, historic buildings in need of some TLC or more. And today, it's not just any historic building, it's the second oldest building in Phoenix.
The 1889 Steiniger Lodging House.
It's on Monroe between Central and First Street, and it's frankly not much to look at. But Rob Malikian, who describes himself as a hopeful historic preservationist, says it's what's on the inside that counts. Malikian's family owns the San Carlos Hotel about half a block away, and he says the Steiniger Lodging House is tied to one of Phoenix's pioneers.
A hardworking, enthusiastic, optimistic man who came to Phoenix, which was a rural, nothing little community here, in the late 1860s. He homesteaded land in the middle of nowhere, which turned out to be between 16th Street and 12th Street, which was west of town at that point. And then the city people voted to move the town to where downtown is right now. He worked very hard on this farm, got enough money to purchase this lot where we're standing in front of right now in 1872. He held on to these lots here and opened an ice cream parlor on Washington. He was the ice cream man for the city of Phoenix.
Then Malikian says three big events happened that helped shape Phoenix. The Arizona Canal brought irrigation to the valley, the railroad came, and Phoenix became the territorial capital in 1889. He says those events also impacted Steiniger.
So he was optimistic. He said, I'm going to pour my money into building a lodging house to accommodate people coming off the train. So in 1889, he builds this 20-room lodging house, and it's very, very successful. Builds up enough money to expand it when, after Roosevelt Dam is built in 1911, he expands it, he doubles the size of the lodging house, and it's one of the main Phoenix lodging houses at that time.
How many rooms were in this lodging house at its peak?
36 rooms, which he and his family lived in the building when it was built. And as you can see, Mark, it appears very ugly because a facade was added in 1935, approximately. And I'll show you a photograph here of the opening of the professional building next door, which is a magnificent Art Deco building in 1935. And here's the Steiniger here, a brick building in 1931. And to keep up with modern times, the family modernized it to adding this white facade. At the time, was very contemporary, but now it's ugly and has a huge crack in it, and people driving by either don't notice it or say, we have to get rid of this eyesore.
It seems surprising that you can drive downtown, and as you said, there's really no evidence on the street here on Monroe that there's anything special back there.
There's a beautiful Victorian two-story detailed building entombed in this ugly facade. The original details are still there, can easily be brought back. I've walked through the building many times. I'm certain it can be restored. It was a very imposing building that you would notice in the old days, and that's the way it originally was intended. But over the years, it's lost its details on the front, which easily could be brought back, though.
What would you like to have happen with this building?
A bar and restaurant would be a natural fit here. There's a huge demand for that now. And if you look at East Monroe, it's built as a non-walking street. There's nothing to do here. It just is concrete and no pedestrian activity. So it needs something desperately. The city needs something here desperately to draw attention by pedestrian activity, and this would be a natural for it.
What condition is the inside like? I mean, how much rehab work would need to go into it?
It takes a lot of work. It is a hard job, but that's what I love to do. I wouldn't have done it. It's not a money-making thing for me, but it's going to cost upwards of $1.2 million to fix up this building. But then you have a huge asset downtown, and in the long run, it's going to pay for itself.
Rob Malikian talking about the Steiniger Lodging House on Monroe between Central and First Street in downtown Phoenix. The property and the professional building right next door are owned by the Minneapolis-based firm CSM. An official with the company says it plans to turn the larger building into a hotel, which he expects to open around this time next year. Malikian says he'd like the company to sell him the deed to the Steiniger property, which he'd then turn into a bar and restaurant or anything else CSM wants. But the CSM official says while it does plan to eventually do something with the Steiniger Lodging House, he couldn't talk about what that might be.
Nearly 2 million people in the U.S. have had a limb amputated, and that number continues to grow as more soldiers return from overseas. Many amputees played sports before losing an arm or leg and are still passionate post-amputation. That's why the new Stand Up Amputee Basketball League at the Sports and Fitness Center for Persons with Disabilities, or SPOFIT, in Phoenix was created. It's the brainchild of David Banks, who has a prosthetic right leg.
I remember just approaching Gus like, hey, is there any opportunities for basketball for amputees? And the reaction was, well, right now, all there is wheelchair basketball. So I looked at that, and it was one of those things where I felt something needed to change. And as I expressed that to Gus, you know, he actually felt the same way. He said, yeah, we should really get together and you know, have some conversation, see if we can create something. So that's kind of how it started.
Gus is Gus Lazar, vice president and general manager of SPOFIT. It's a 45,000-square-foot workout and rehabilitation facility for amputees, veterans, and people with disabilities.
The program I used to coordinate, we call it the right to risk, you know, and so giving people the opportunity, if they were injured in an accident or they were an aggressive athlete, if you will. But providing that program and having the right to risk, get it back out there and do what they want to do. And that's where this program kind of evolved from.
The games are played on Wednesday nights, but just got started 2 weeks ago. So there aren't enough players to substitute in to go full court. But David Banks says competing 5-on-5, even half court, is a great feeling.
It takes me back all the things I loved about basketball and about sports, the camaraderie, the relationships you build, the ability to get, you know, five strangers onto a court and play together as a team. I mean, you only get that in sports or in clubs. So that's a lot of stuff that I missed. And being able to get back into sports and back into basketball on that level, mm-hmm. it just brings all that back. So for a long time, I was finding ways to kind of, because this is 15 years later to where we really got to this level of establishing this. I wish I had done it sooner.
What were your strengths before as a player? What are your strengths now?
Great question. Yeah, you know, I'm only 5'10". I was a dunker. I was an elite basketball player. I was a point guard. I could dunk. I was a two-hand, two-foot jumper dunker. And I had a shot, and I had speed. You know, I can drive to the lane, right hand or left hand. So it definitely, the biggest challenge for me was changing my perspective as to what I can do. So, I mean, it definitely changed my game. I don't think I'll be dunking anytime soon. I mean, the game is different. It's still the joy of being able to get out there, run up and down the court. I can do it at my new activity level, and I'm surrounded by guys who share that same activity level. So it works.
So what's different about teamwork, if at anything, when you're in an amputee league as opposed to another league?
Nothing. I mean, if anything, you know, we really have to communicate more, lean on each other more. But no, it's nothing changes. You still have that same camaraderie, the guys coming together for one common goal and, you know, just getting a good workout and having fun on the court. So no, I really don't think there's any difference.
And you sure as hell haven't lost competitiveness either. I'm sure when you guys get out there, this is not like, oh, let's take it easy on each other.
No, we're beating each other up. I was sore after our first event. I was sore, literally. The game was on Wednesday. I didn't start feeling better till Sunday.
And though Banks says inspiring others isn't the aim of the stand-up league.
I go to the gym sometimes and I'll work out and I'll get able-bodied guys who come up to me and go, God, you inspire me. And at first, it always surprised me, like, really? I mean, you know, you got all your arms and legs, you know, you're a big guy, you know. And one of the gentlemen was like, well, what it is that all week I made an excuse about why not to come to the gym. Oh, I'm not feeling good. Oh, you know, my ankle hurts. Oh, you know, my back's hurting. And I made excuses all week. And finally, you know, it's Friday. And you know, I really just made a decision to actually come. And then after seeing you, I looked at you and I'm seeing you. You got one leg and you're on the treadmill. You're squatting. You're doing bench press. You're doing everything. You inspired me to really know that I can do anything and not let the negative thoughts in my mind dominate me.
Banks and Lazar are hoping the league expands in the near future. They're even welcoming non-amputees to take the court.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Two people are dead in a shooting at a high school outside Seattle. Police say the shooter was a student at Marysville Pilchuck High School and is one of the dead. Three students are in critical condition at Providence Everett Medical Center with gunshot wounds. Dr. Joanne Roberts, chief medical officer at Providence, says they were ready.
Unfortunately, we've seen these shootings across the country. We had dreaded this day in this community, but we were prepared to handle these kids when they came here.
And Carolyn Adolph with member station KUOW in Seattle was at a nearby church where students were reunited with their parents.
There's so many tears here. The looks on the faces of the young people of real trauma. All of them are shaking and they're still crying. I've seen large young men from high school, obviously seniors who are just clinging to their parents, and young girls as well who are holding tightly to their mother's hands. This is a community that has really suffered a major shock, and they're going through it right now. They're doing some processing of it, but mostly what they're just trying to do is get their child and get home.
Carolyn Adolph from member station KUOW reporting. Two nurses with Ebola who cared for Thomas Duncan, the Liberian man who died from the virus at a Dallas hospital, are now free of the disease.
I feel fortunate and blessed to be standing here today.
Nina Pham was treated at the National Institutes of Health outside Washington, D.C. She met with the president at the White House after she was released. And Amber Vincent, the other nurse, is also free of the disease, but she's still being cared for at a hospital in Atlanta. Wall Street was higher today by the closing bell. The Dow up 127 points, ending at 16,805. The Nasdaq up 30 points to close at 4483. The S&P 500 up 13. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Walton Family Foundation, whose K-12 initiative works to empower families with quality school choices. WaltonK12.org.
Arizona has a reputation as a good place to retire, but not everyone who retires wants to stop working.
Next week, Encore is bringing its annual conference to Tempe. The group helps retirees pursue what it calls second acts, often with nonprofits. One of those retirees is Nels Johnson. He's in his late 60s and is part of a group called Boomer Serving Arizona Schools. He volunteers at Maya High School in Phoenix. He joined me along with Nora Hanna, the CEO of Phoenix-based Experience Matters, which is affiliated with Encore.
We were formed to really take it, leverage this, our second biggest natural resource. Everyone thinks it's solar power, but we have a large community of baby boomers, one of the largest. And now that they're retiring, we put them to work on projects in the nonprofit and social sector.
And Nels, I presume that you work with Experience Matters. How did you get started doing your volunteer work?
Well, I moved here about 4 years ago and met a wonderful person who was connected with Experience Matters, and I was talking to her about how I was still had a lot of energy, wanted to keep busy, so I was interested in doing some volunteer work. And she introduced me to Experience Matters, and the rest is history.
When you were in your quote-unquote working life, what did you do?
I was a senior manager in the waste disposal and recycling business.
So what was it like to decide, okay, I've retired, like I've got all this spare time on my hands, I can play golf, I can read, I can sleep late, do whatever, but here you are sort of basically going back to work?
Well, I had a wonderful experience in my working career coaching at a boys and girls club, which I did for years and years and years. And I love working with kids, love giving something back, learned a lot about myself in that capacity, so I didn't want to lose that.
Nora, you have a conference coming here next week. What is that all about?
Well, we're part of a national network, if you will, of organizations that are formed for the same purpose. And one of the largest ones is called Encore.org. They're based in California, and for the first time, they're having their national conference here in Tempe.
What does it mean for the Valley and for Arizona that this group is holding this conference here?
Interestingly enough, we're held up nationally as one of the best practice areas for this. So Arizona isn't always known for great things, but in this case, we're actually a national model for how we engage older adults in social purpose work.
In what ways?
Mostly because we've been so successful at being able to make a lot of these matches, as we call them. We've matched about 250 individuals, and it's had such a huge benefit to the nonprofit community. We think we've added about $10 million in human capital to the nonprofits in this community, and it's only going up from there.
In that sense, do you mean that some of these organizations don't have to go and hire somebody and pay them a salary and benefits and all? They can rely on volunteer work and maybe give them a pizza every now and then?
That's exactly right. I mean, sometimes there's a small stipend associated with it, but for the most part, they're getting people like Nels who have incredible skills and talents far beyond what they could normally afford.
So what kinds of things will attendees at the conference be hearing about, talking about, learning about?
They'll be learning about all the new ideas going on in this area, and it's quite broad. There are a lot of people publishing in this area, so there's a lot of individuals who are coming into this stage of life who are becoming very active, and we want to make sure we leverage that.
Nels, do you have friends and family who are around your age who are doing the same kinds of things as you are?
I have some friends. My family's not local here, but I do have some friends that are engaged in doing some of the same kind of things.
What was it like for you when you first started doing that? Because it's a little different than what you did as a job.
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because I had a real aha moment when I first joined this organization. They connected me with a school which has some interesting demographics, entirely different than what I was used to when my kids grew up or in my personal experiences. So I wasn't sure I would fit into this school. And I sat in on a faculty meeting at the invitation of the principal. And he went around the room and asked each teacher to comment about some of the success stories that they had observed with their students. I couldn't believe it. And I was hooked at that moment, because you could see that each teacher was so concerned about helping their students self-actualize and improve. So that's the moment that hooked me with this organization.
What kinds of opportunities do you tend to match up the people who come to you with, and what kinds of volunteer-type jobs are they doing?
Well, it's a really wide range. Everything from doing strategic plans, looking at human resources, creating a marketing strategy, to working a few hours a week as an academic mentor in school. So the beauty of it is everyone can do something, so you don't really want to miss that opportunity to remain active.
That's interesting, because I kind of created my own position when I finally connected to the school. Nora's correct. We have kind of an open-ended book to we have some guidelines, but from there you can expand and do something that you think is creative that will help the school. So that's kind of what I did.
Nora, how do you go about trying to match people and sort of figure out what their skill set is if it's not necessarily what they did as a career, maybe isn't so obvious what they might be good at?
You know, that's where we put most of our energy, and we always say the magic is in the match. So we spend a lot of time interviewing our candidates to make sure we uncover what it is that they love to do. We had an electrical engineer, and we didn't know where to place him with nonprofits, but we found out he had a passion for music. We ended up placing him with a fabulous nonprofit that teaches kids music, and he created their sound studios for them. So he connected his passion for music, his electrical engineering background, to help students learn music.
After this conference next week, do you think that Arizona will sort of gain any sort of residual benefits from having had that here?
Absolutely. I think we're bringing a lot of resources into Arizona, not specifically around the conference, but around groups that want to learn about how they can invest in this and bring this to their own communities. So it's going to continue to grow, not just locally, but nationally.
Nora Hanna is CEO of Experience Matters. I was also joined by Nels Johnson, who volunteers at Maya High School in Phoenix.
Sex is a topic that's often on the minds of college students, but how well are colleges and universities doing in helping students be sexually healthy? For a ninth consecutive year, Bert Sperling of the independent research firm Sperling's Best Places has conducted the Sexual Health Report Card. The top-ranked school is Oregon State University, while the University of Arizona was number 4. ASU came in at number 67. Sperling explains the list.
When we're talking about sexual health, we can't measure, say, the number of STDs, the sexually transmitted diseases or illnesses, or that sort of thing, on the college campus. And frankly, we don't want to be invasive or anything like that. But what we're measuring in this case is the information and the resources that are available to students so they can make their right best decision. And another thing we don't care about, we don't try to measure the amount of sexual activity or anything like that. That's kind of invasive. So what we're doing is we're just trying to see that the students have the kind of resources, services, and information they need to make their own smart, best decisions, healthy decisions.
I wonder if you could comment on whether you're seeing certain trends.
Overall, the trend we're seeing is that all the colleges we're looking at are becoming better at providing information and services to the students.
Ranked in the top 10 is one of Arizona's large public universities, University of Arizona, but much lower, closer to the middle of the pack, is Arizona State University. Anything specific you could relate to those two?
The middle of the pack is still really good. In fact, if we were going to give it a grade, for instance, maybe University of Arizona would get an A+, because they're number 4 on our ranking, 4 in the entire country out of 140 schools. Instead, at 67, is Arizona State, but that would still rate a B. They're still doing a really good job. As far as information, providing, say, male contraceptives, for instance, we find that the Arizona State is not providing that much information and providing them as readily.
Something that's been getting a lot of attention lately nationally is the number of sexual assaults on campus and how universities are handling that kind of thing. And I would think that would go into sexual health as well.
From the beginning, we wanted to make sure that information about sexual assault was available to the students. For instance, what was sexual assault, how to report it readily, make sure there's a 1-800 number or a campus line that's available at the hotline 24 hours a day. They don't have to call, say, 911 and get the police or whatever, but it can be handled immediately on campus. That's what we looked at, but we didn't look at how, say, past incidences were done that. We're not experts in trying to evaluate, say, the legalities of that and how things are handled, so that was outside our scope.
Bert Sperling of the independent research firm Sperling's Best Places on the Sexual Health Report Card.
Still to come, if orange is the new black, is there a new beige in Phoenix?
Phoenix has this really great history with architecture that a lot of people don't really notice because we've got buildings covered in beige.
We'll brighten things up on the show.
Good afternoon. Look for mostly sunny skies this weekend around the valley with a high of 95 tomorrow and then 90 on Sunday. We're currently at 94 degrees. Looks like the afternoon commute has started early this Friday afternoon. Watch out for a couple of troublesome accidents. I-17 northbound at Union Hills, blocking the right lane, and the 202 westbound at 24th Street.
KJZZ is supported by the Grammy-winning Phoenix Chorale presenting Requiem Day of the Dead. Requiem settings by composers Maurice Duruflé and Herbert Howells, November 1st and 2nd. Tickets and video clips at phoenixchorale.org.
KJZZ is exploring what it means to be part of community in a series called We Are the Valley. This week, we're taking a spin at the Great Arizona Puppet Theater with a group of folk dancers who like to stomp and twirl and switch partners to old-time tunes. KJZZ's Stina Sieg introduces us to the world of contra dance.
Balance is weak.
Sit on the sidelines of a contra dance, and the first thing you'll probably notice are the long lines of dancers. The second, the smiles, constant and on nearly everyone's face.
It's just fun.
Ronnie Burroughs fell in love with contra about 30 years ago. Tonight, she's dancing with other contra veterans, but also beginning dancers. She, like many contra lovers, makes a point to send a welcoming vibe to newbies. She says that with other dance forms, the learning curve can be steep.
But people come in their first day contra, they're on the floor, they're dancing, they're having a good time, their very first dance.
That's because contra is meant to be something everyone can do. It's been that way since the 1700s, when it began as a barn dance on the East Coast. Since then, the formula has pretty much stayed the same, with elements borrowed from French and English dance styles. Live music, a caller yelling out the steps, couples progressing up and down the dance hall. They're doing allemands and promenades and ladies' chains. It might sound complicated, but Ron Neiman, who helped start the Phoenix Dances 30 years ago, promises it's not.
It doesn't require anything other than being able to walk and just be able to enjoy other people.
Neiman can't walk anymore, but is still an important part of this community. He manages the sound system for the bands, and his wife dances. He says contra is, by nature, social.
And it kind of is set up to force you to meet other people.
It's a contra expectation that you'll ask many different people to dance over the course of a night. And Neiman says during one 10-minute contra, you don't just dance with that one partner, but lots of other people. You meet new ones every time the music cycles.
If you didn't find a spark or didn't find a friend or something, you wait 30 seconds, you'll get another chance.
That joy of matching your movement, someone else's movement, rhythm, music, your heart, your soul, all together.
Ronnie Burroughs says that also creates a sense of togetherness between the dancers. She says that when a member of the contra community recently died, so many dancers went to his funeral.
So not just the dancing, but people are concerned for each other and take care of each other and get involved in each other's lives.
And they come together every 2 weeks in Phoenix. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News.
The next contra dance is tonight at 7 at the Irish Cultural Center with live music from, and I'm going to be careful with this, Clusterfolk. If you're part of a community that makes up a big part of your life, tell us about it for our We Are the Valley series. Send us a note, wearethevalley@kjzz.org.
So whenever I have friends or family come to town to visit, without fail, one of the first things they say is how brown the valley is. And they're not just talking about the landscape. But a Phoenix design firm says the area is starting to break up with beige. Christina Johnson is a partner with Private Label International, which is forecasting pops of color coming to a building near you. We met in the courtyard of Cabana on Thomas, a Phoenix apartment complex.
It started with a lot of the hotels around the valley, with the Valley Ho and with the Sanctuary, really wanting to, just introduce some color. And I'm a native to Arizona, and so I've seen the valley evolve for the past, several decades. And so it's really just been these last few years that it's, just popping up everywhere, a lot of color.
Why do you think that is?
Well, for one, it's refreshing. Especially in the valley, we saw just some not really fun things going on with the real estate, with the recession. And so part of it, too, is that Phoenix has this really great history with architecture that a lot of people don't really notice because we've got buildings covered in beige. But these buildings are all built in the 60s and the 70s and this really great mid-century modern architecture. And we have it all over the valley. I mean, it's so rich with it. And so during that recession, when a lot of people weren't building new anymore, they were renovating instead. And so they were buying up these properties that were built in that era and trying to infuse life into them, bring them back to, their former glory, so to speak. But color is a big part of the retro vibe.
Is this a property that you guys have worked on?
This is. Yeah, this was one of ours that was done, it was completed a couple years ago. It's one of the Cabana brands. And we've also done several other properties that have just wanted to bring color into the spaces. We've also found that buyers and leasers, they're a little bit more design savvy. They're also more risky. They are, opening themselves up to color and to taking risks and to wanting to do things that are a little bit more fun.
So looking around here, we're standing in the courtyard, and all the doors are sort of an aqua blue type color. The pool chairs, the lounge chairs out here are all different colors. Do you have to be careful in terms of adding this kind of color? I mean, I noticed the entire building is still basically brown.
Yeah, absolutely. This particular property, there was a whole strategy to it, and I almost felt like a scientist mixing my colors because this particular property has 32 exterior colors, which is insane. That's the most number of colors we've done on any property. And you absolutely have to. The main color palette's neutral. That's the key to bringing in color and pattern, is that you have to pair it with neutral, or you have to pair it with like a natural material. If you're bringing in woods, it's like dressing yourself in the morning. You're not going to put like some crazy color pattern on top and an even crazier color pattern on the bottom. If you do, that's great. That's your thing. But most of the time, you're going to pair it and balance it. So, and that's how you have to look at a building as well.
Have you found that most of the places that have been incorporating more colors have been buildings that are not houses? Because if you drive around the valley, it seems far less likely to see a house that's not brown as opposed to a hotel, apartment building, office building, things like that.
Well, there's definitely properties that lead the trend. And so it starts most of the time when we see trends, it'll start with a hotel and then it'll bleed all the way down to residential.
Have you heard any pushback from folks who have said, look, you're kind of taking away from our natural environment? That's why we painted everything brown in the first place.
Yeah, and it really depends on the area of the valley. There are some areas of the valley that just lend themselves to color and then others that don't. You know, to say that color is not natural, a lot of people have that misnomer. But in all actuality, I mean, a lot of the colors you can pull from nature. And a lot of times we'll do that. Okay, you want a natural color palette, we'll pull rust from rocks, we'll pull blue from the sky, we'll pull the sunset colors. I mean, there's ways to incorporate that while still blending in with, our beautiful natural desert scenery.
Christina Johnson is partner with the design firm Private Label International.
It's one of the most recognizable mountains in Phoenix. Perched on one of its peaks is a visitor stop with a magnificent view of the valley. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez takes us there.
Dobbins Lookout is located on South Mountain. Did you know it is the highest viewing point accessible to visitors by trail?
Almost 2,330 feet of elevation. It's just a great vantage point.
Justin Olson is a ranger at South Mountain Park.
I mean, I can make out Tempe, downtown Phoenix, and on a clear day, see clear up north to the Phoenix Mountain Preserves and beyond.
Olson escorts me to Dobbin's lookout in his truck because the road that leads to the peak is closed and visitors are not allowed to drive there for safety reasons. Recent monsoon storms damaged the area and construction crews are making road repairs. Once at Dobbin's lookout, everything is stable and the view majestic.
Look at all this.
Just ahead is the notable stone ramada, a structure that looks much like a small house. Olson says it was built in the 1930s after the city of Phoenix petitioned the U.S. government to transfer at a minimal price more than 14,000 acres of the mountain range to the city for public use.
It was built by the Civilian Conservation Corps. These were a group of young men who were put to work during the Depression. So the 18 to 23-year-olds who were unemployed really didn't have any skills. They could come out here, learn new skills. They would actually earn around $30 a month.
The lookout was named after James C. Dobbins, the chairman of the Phoenix Planning Commission, who spearheaded the efforts to purchase the land. Also built on Dobbins' lookout is an observation tower.
There's a compass, and it has a series of demarcations on the top to kind of point you towards different landmarks around the valley, like Camelback Mountains, Piestewa Peak, Phoenix Mountain Preserves, Glendale, different major cities, Tempe, Chandler around here, so you can really get your bearings.
Thousands of visitors make their way up here each year, by day and night. The summit road leading to the lookout is expected to be open by the end of this year. In the meantime, visitors can still hike one of the many trails that leads to Dobbins Lookout. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique or things that we should know, send us a note. It's the show at kjzz.org.
Well, the show was produced this week by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nick Blumberg, Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer, Maria Springs, and Aubrey Abril are our digital team. Our managing editor is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban. We always like to hear from you. We like to know what you think, any good story ideas, other things. Maybe you want to send us some photos of what you're doing over the weekend. That's cool. The show at kjzz.org.
For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. All Things Considered is next on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. We'll be back with the show next Thursday and Friday. Hope you'll tune in. It's 3 o'clock.